Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and think back to March and April of this year in the heart of the Arab Spring, when practically every news site in the world was scrambling to track the uprisings. Maps showing developments in Tunisia, then Egypt, Syria, Bahrain, Yemen, Iraq, Saudi Arabia. On this show, we were in round-robin mode, trying to keep up with the latest developments, one or two segments every day. And reporters based in the Middle East turned into roving revolution trackers. That's exactly what happened to NPR's Kelly McEvers. We were just talking off the air about how she was based in Baghdad, and now she's sort of based nowhere and everywhere as NPR's foreign correspondent based in the region. You've heard her reporting over the last 8 months from Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Saudi Arabia. Kelly McEvers is in New York today and joins us to reflect on an Arab Spring that, judging by today's news alone from Yemen and Egypt, for example, continues very unresolved into the fall. Kelly, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
I shouldn't say welcome because you're on our air constantly, but welcome to our studios.
In the flesh.
Now, I know you aren't based in Egypt, but that, of course, is the main news right now. And to recap a little bit, Coptic Christians are protesting the killing of almost 30 protesters earlier this week by the Interim Military Council government. Just today, Egypt's finance minister, who is a deputy prime minister, has resigned over the government's treatment of the protesters. Does the outbreak of violence in Egypt this week and the government's role in it tell us that this is not the democratic revolution that we so hoped it would be?
Yeah, I think the euphoria has definitely worn off. I think we knew that in the summer, but this is now the final kind of, you know, punctuation on that moment in Tahrir Square when everybody thought, oh, great, it's over. You know, it's interesting because what happens in Egypt has such an effect on all the other countries that are in the midst of their own revolutions. You know, I think Yemenis, for instance, or people who are still in the process of protesting say, maybe it wasn't such a good idea to just get rid of the dictator so quickly and then try to rebuild the country. So I think in some ways, although it's, it is a warning sign that there's probably a lot of instability to come in the region as different sects, different groups, different religions sort of vie for power in these power vacuums. It's also sort of a lesson that, you know, maybe we should do some of this nation building and institution building before we get rid of the dictator, because that's not the only step we need to take.
Except the dictators refuse to do it in most cases.
Yeah, there's that problem too. I mean, also, I sort of like to joke that I've been on the revolutions that haven't worked. I've been doing the ones that either have failed outright, which is Bahrain, and the two that are sort of still ongoing, which is Syria and Yemen. And what you see in those places, in some ways, that the dictators are learning from the mistakes of the previous dictators. You know, Gaddafi in Libya made the mistake of kind of going forward and saying, we're going to hunt these people down like rats and kill them. And that, of course, gave justification to the international community to come in and intervene. You know, then you look at Syria, President Bashar al-Assad, he doesn't even talk about the protesters now. And I feel like he's learned from Gaddafi's mistakes. You know, he's made just a couple of speeches since this whole thing began back in March in his country, and doesn't even say anything. You know, he talks a little bit sort of, you know, about sort of vaguely about, you know, instability and the need to reform. But that's it. You know, if you don't talk about it, then it's not actually a problem.
Now, the Coptic Christian issue in Egypt, you know, it has a lot of Americans wondering and a lot of media speculating, aha, the radical fringe of Muslim Egypt is rising up with violence against. There was a church bombing. Is that part of what started this off?
Right.
And this is the Muslim Brotherhood and the worst form that everybody feared it would be. But is it that?
They are an element in many of these countries. They're an element in Syria. They're an element in Libya. They're an element in Egypt. But to sort of raise the flag and say that they're going to take it over and co-opt these movements is just not correct.
Is the government military, though, backing up that wing of the
sure.
movement,
I mean, that's,
in effect?
In
with
Egypt,
its...
I'm not going to be able to speak about it because I haven't done reporting there. But, I mean, is it in different regimes' interests to do that? Absolutely. I mean, I think you see that in Syria. You've got... I think there's definite involvement by places like Saudi Arabia because it's in Saudi's interest to see the regime fall in Syria. So there's speeches in mosques. There's probably money coming through. But is that the only element of the protest movement? And is it an element that's going to, in the end, win out? I just don't think so. I mean, you just can't overstate the impact of millions of, you know, sort of 20 to 25-year-olds who are just so unbelievably engaged in how their countries are going to go forward in the future and how committed they are to it.
Kelly McEvers, NPR Middle East correspondent, in our studio today, 212-433-WNYC. Do you want to reflect a bit on the Nobel Peace Prize going, in part, it was a shared prize this year, to a Yemeni woman, Tawakkul Karman? You filed a piece from Yemen on her in August. Who is she, and were you surprised that she won the Nobel Peace Prize?
I wasn't surprised. I have to say I was really happy to see that, because the movement in Yemen is so fractured and is just struggling so hard. And here is a woman who has been living in a tent for 7 months. She has three children. She's in her 30s. She's a journalist. She's a professional. You know, she otherwise would have a job during the day, but instead she has chosen to live in a tent at a place they called Change Square. And she hasn't left. I mean, this is what she does now. This is her life. And so to have that sort of internationally recognized in some way, I'm sure will galvanize the movement within Yemen and just sort of legitimizes her as well in a way that I think she's feeling like the Yemenis have been, you know, ignored by the international community. I feel like this will give them more of that recognition that they feel like they haven't gotten. You know, America's stepped up and supported the revolutions in some places, but not so much in others.
Yeah. Now, I read that yesterday in the city of Taiz, a march in support of her turned violent with dozens of women injured. Is there a chance that the added attention of the Peace Prize will backfire and lead to further crackdown?
There is a chance that there's going to be crackdown in Yemen all the time. I'm not sure that the Peace Prize in particular is going to spark this off. I mean, there are pretty much four little civil wars brewing right now in Yemen ever since the protests. I mean, there were kind of already some conflicts going on, but this crisis has only made it worse. And what you have, this is the problem, right? You have a president who three times has promised to step down according to a plan that was sort of put together by his neighbors and by the U.S., and three times he's backed down. He's reneged. And so the situation just gets more and more volatile as we go forward.
I was struck by this from your piece on Tawakkul Karman. You reported that when she first started organizing years ago, quote, each protest was about a single issue, the jailing of a journalist, a land grab, a corrupt official. But then Karman realized her project was about much more than individual issues. Quote, we have to start our country from new. We have to own our own country, unquote. And I'm struck by how much of the conversation in this country around Occupy Wall Street right now is how they don't have a specific issue agenda. But you seem to be saying that Karman was successful when her protests became more diffuse.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. I mean, and that's what Tunisia did. I think that's what Tunisia and Egypt did for these people. I mean, it said, wait a second, you can actually, like, the more sort of general the message is, like, we don't like the regime, the easier it is to get people in the street and then start talking. I mean, this is what's so amazing about these tents in Yemen, right? It's like being in a university poli-sci class every single night. You know, I was there during Ramadan, so you wait until the sun goes down, you break the fast, and then you stay up until like 4 o'clock in the morning, debating, talking, arguing. You know, people are passing out pamphlets, presenting papers, research. You know, I mean, it's just this incredible sort of democracy experiment going on in these tents.
Do protesters and pro-democracy activists in this country, those countries, continue to think of themselves as part of the same movement that started with Tunisia and Egypt in the Arab Spring, or just country by country?
They do. They identify themselves with the larger movement. You'll see on Twitter all the time, you know, when something happens in Yemen, you'll see Bahrainis, we're standing with you. When Tawakkul first heard that she got the Nobel, she stood up on the stage in Change Square and said, I accept this on behalf of all Yemenis, and I accept this on behalf of all Arabs who are standing in the street right now.
Wow.
Doing this. I mean, that is how they see it. And it's Twitter that's helped them, you know, talk to each other.
And I realize you're there and not here, but is it crazy to consider Occupy Wall Street, an offshoot, not of the Arab Spring per se, but as somehow of a global uprising of young people concerned about economic inequality? Obviously, conditions are so different here.
Sure.
Than under, you know, Assad in Syria or something like that. So is it crazy to even talk about it in the same breath?
Of this notion that you can go out into the streets and ask for what you want. I want to say that they're connected. I want to feel that. The first thing I did when I got to New York was go down and just hang out, you know, and I was pretty overcome with emotion because, you know, it's it's the ability to stand in a park and do what the people are doing in Occupy Wall Street that the kids are fighting for in the Arab world. You know, it's the ability to just do that, to have the freedom to come out and do that. You know, so the stakes are very different, but I mean, there's got to be a connection.
Kelly Evers, NPR Middle East correspondent, visiting New York today. Ahmed in Woodside. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Brian. And, I listen to you every day. I miss you for the last week.
Thank you. I was only off on Friday, but go ahead.
Okay. I was busy.
Okay.
And I just have a comment here for nation building. Your guest mentioned maybe we look at some alternative that before we get rid of dictatorship. The U.S. policy and the aim in Afghanistan was failing for many years, almost 10 years, for nation building. And also in Iraq, the story is not really perfect or successful. Now, she can elaborate a little bit about how you approach the best way than the revolution and the people mm-hmm. continue pushing the dictator for change.
Thank you very much. It changed from within, or you have to topple the government.
Right. So I've been based in Iraq and have been going back and forth there. And Iraq is such an interesting example right now, right? I mean, they got rid of the dictator. It was from without. It wasn't from within. But it is in the process of building a country, of building a democracy. There's a parliament in Iraq, a very active parliament. There are political parties. There is a political process. It's ugly. It's messy. But in some ways, I feel like Iraq could serve as an example. I think Iraqis are actually trying to reach out to their neighbors at this time. I mean, the problem, it gets a little complicated because of the sectarianism that's still kind of at play. But I think a lot of Iraqis are trying to reach out to the neighbors and say, look, this is how you build a country. It's not pretty, but here are our experiences. Here's what we can show you.
On the other hand, the leaders of the Iraqi government have moved closer to Syria. They've hosted diplomats, and Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki recently said, we believe Syria will be able to overcome its crisis through reforms. In other words, kind of supporting Assad remaining in power. They're closer with Iran than before the war.
Right, because the majority Shiites are now in power, and of course they are going to be the ones who are aligned with Iran. And Iran, being Syria's greatest ally in the region, I'm sure was keen on Maliki coming forward and saying something like that publicly. I mean, this is where you get into this sort of complicated issue of the Arab revolutions turning into a larger, potentially regional sectarian conflict, where you have the kind of Shiite resistance, Iran, Hezbollah, and the Assad regime in Syria on one side, and the Sunni powers on the other side, Saudi Arabia, traditionally the protesters in Syria. You know, some people call it a cold war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, but it's got very sectarian tones to it as well. And this is why there was such a big problem in Bahrain. It was largely seen as a Sunni versus Shiite thing. And that's why Saudi Arabia, you know, sent troops in to quash it immediately.
Kelly Evers, NPR Middle East correspondent, visiting New York today. This was great. So nice of you to come and stop by for a few minutes. Where's your next stop?
Sure. I'm heading to Iraq and then probably back to Yemen.
Kelly McEvers, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Listeners, tonight at 8 o'clock, the next GOP debate is live from New Hampshire. Tonight's debate is focused entirely on the economy, they tell us. Tax reform, jobs, the GOP reaction to Occupy Wall Street will no doubt come up. And as usual, our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, is hosting a live online chat during the debate. You can watch video streaming of the debate and join the It's a Free Country politics team and your fellow WNYC listeners. All you need is a computer and a love of politics. It all starts tonight at 8 on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, very special guest coming up next, the brand new executive editor of the New York Times, first woman ever to hold that job, Jill Abramson. Stay with us.